Riley, Judge Grapple, the Honorable John R. Monenberg presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As noted, my name is John Rodenberg. With me today are Judges Riley and Bratfold. We have four in-person oral matters and then an ITV oral argument after that. The first of the cases is Ayers versus Kalal. Am I pronouncing the name correctly?
Kalla, Your Honor.
Kalal?
Kalla.
Kalla.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. And it looks like counsel are both ready to proceed. You'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for our recording. The podium is adjustable, and there's a little toggle switch somewhere down below, and you can adjust the height to suit your own comfort. With that, appellant may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Patrick Arneson, and I represent the appellants in this matter, the City of Burnsville and John Kalla. Now, this is a case that did not need to be tried twice. After a week of trial, the jury considered the evidence, reached a reasoned and unanimous verdict, and that verdict should have been allowed to stand. However, the district court granted respondent Justin Ayers' motion for a new trial on damages and abused its discretion in doing so. And this abuse of discretion really boils down to two related questions for purpose of this appeal. First, who gets to decide the credibility of an expert witness, the judge or the jury? And the related question, if there's evidence that renders the expert's opinions improbable or contradicts those opinions, is the jury allowed to find that the expert's opinion was not credible, even if that's the only expert in the case? And the district court abuses discretion in not allowing the jury to decide the credibility of the expert and to decide whether or not the expert's opinions were credible in the sense that they matched the facts of the case and the other evidence in this case.
In that first trial, was there a motion for a partial directed verdict on the permanent injury question?
I do not recall, Your Honor. I do not believe so, but I do not recall for sure. I did not make such a motion. So the district court had discretion to grant a new trial under certain pretty stringent criteria. That is that the verdict so contrary to the preponderance of the evidence as to imply that the jury failed to consider all the evidence or acted under some mistake. But if a verdict has any reasonable evidentiary support, it should be allowed to stand. And here the verdict did have reasonable evidentiary support. The main question as to what evidence we're talking about here is, was there evidence to support the jury's implicit finding that Mr. Ayers' left shoulder and left hand conditions were not caused by the motor vehicle accident? And the answer is there was more than enough evidence to support that finding by the jury. Because, as it should be clear, this verdict was a plaintiff's verdict. The jury was not under any kind of bias or prejudice against Mr. Ayers. Clearly, they found for Mr. Ayers and awarded him damages and all the medical expenses relating to the care and the conditions he'd reported and been treated for in the first several months after the accident.
What? I don't want to throw you off your argument.
Yes,
but
Your Honor.
I want to deal with the first issue that you raised in your brief, which is the snow and ice immunity. I see that you've jumped forward to your second issue. How does Hoff impact that first issue?
Well, Your Honor, I was planning to get to that, obviously, but as long as you've raised the question, I want to first say that the appellate issue here is not so much the merits of the immunity question as it is, did the district court err by not allowing the jury to decide material issues of fact relating to that question, which had previously been noted by the district court at the summary judgment stage and then by a different panel of this court in an earlier appeal, that there were fact issues that needed to be decided before immunity could be determined as a matter of law. District court failed to do that. That's the nature of the appellate argument there.
I don't see our prior opinion, which I've got before me now, I didn't see it as saying that there was a fact question. What the earlier panel said was the facts as to the condition of Highway 13 have yet to be developed. So it seems as if the earlier panel of this court might have considered that it was just premature and there needed to be more discovery done on that question, and it apparently was done before the case was tried.
I don't think there was any additional discovery on that point, Your Honor. So I believe all the evidence that was before the Court of Appeals at that time was consistent with all the evidence that came in at trial. And I read that part of the opinion as saying there is a fact issue on this. Therefore, their summary judgment is not appropriate at this time. But as to Judge Riley's question about Hoff, obviously Judge Bradfold is going to be the authority on this, and I'm not going to...
Oh, I just write for the panel. That's all I do.
All right. Well, I'm not going to pretend to know more about that particular case than Judge Bradfold or
And I guess I just, to direct your comments, I don't think it's about that case. I think the question is, it seems to be you're arguing that even with the decision in the Hoff matter, that this judge somehow submitted the snow or failed to submit snow and ice immunity to the jury. And I'm just curious, how would that get submitted to the jury? What was the mistake? What should the judge have done that the judge didn't do?
What the judge should have done, Your Honor, was allow certain special verdict questions to go forward to the jury.
You didn't move for a new trial, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You didn't move for a new trial, did you?
Correct. I did not move for a new trial.
I don't know how you can raise a special verdict form.
Well, ordinarily, questions on a special verdict form are subject to judicial discretion and have to be raised through a motion for new trial. That's correct. But here, it's not so much the issue as to the wording of the special verdict form. The issue is, as a matter of law, the judge decided the immunity issue without allowing the jury to answer the predicate questions of fact. And that's a substantive legal issue that...
You also have to show prejudicial effect, don't you? And an error in a verdict form. And that is something that a judge typically decides on a new trial motion in the first instance. Then it comes to this court. But to preserve it, I think you have to. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Point me to a case that says otherwise.
Your Honor, there were cases cited in appellant's brief that I think the Alpha something or other was one of the primary cases.
That was
cases.
A special verdict form case? Alpha Real Estate?
I don't recall if that was a special verdict form, but it was the fundamental issue of law issue, which is what we have here.
And I know I'm familiar with that basic rule of law. I'm just troubled by your claim that this judge should have somehow altered the special verdict form, but that as appellant, you don't have an obligation to bring that up in a new trial motion. I'm just unfamiliar with Minnesota law that suggests that. But I don't want to take up all your time on that point. I understand that you want to make sure you get on to the other issues, so...
Thank you, Your Honor, and I may come back to that. But on the issue of the evidence presented at trial, because this was critically important, there was a lot of evidence that supported the jury's verdict in finding that Dr. Wengler, who is plaintiff's medical expert, was not credible in saying that the left hand and left shoulder condition were permanent conditions caused by the motor vehicle accident.
He was the only expert in that trial, correct?
He was the only...
On that issue.
On that issue, Your Honor, correct. The only expert who testified. And one of the exhibits in particular, Exhibit 24-003, which is a medical record that talked about this weightlifting injury of Mr. Ayers, was only one page, but that single page presented about 9 different reasons for the jury to find that Dr. Wengler's opinion on causation was not reasonable and did not fit the facts of the case. And I'll quickly roll through those. First, the fact that Mr. Ayers did not mention his shoulder condition to his doctors until 3 months after the accident, because that's how long this particular record was after the accident. The fact that at that time, he said he injured his left shoulder while weightlifting. The fact that he not only said he injured his left shoulder by weightlifting, but that he felt something tear in his shoulder while weightlifting, which was consistent with the diagnosis of the specific injury claimed by Dr. Wengler to have been caused by the motor vehicle accident. The fact that Mr. Ayers had had problems with his shoulder ever since the weightlifting incident, well before the motor vehicle accident. The fact Mr. Ayers did not say the motor vehicle accident injured his shoulder or aggravated any pre-existing injury. The fact that Mr. Ayers, well, did not say his left shoulder symptoms got any worse because of the motor vehicle accident.
But then I don't understand your trial strategy, which was when the judge asked you if you wanted a special verdict question about aggravation of a pre-existing injury, you said, no, we don't want that.
Correct, Your Honor. As it turned out, there did not seem to be any evidence that his pre-existing condition was aggravated. He had a pre-existing condition, but it wasn't aggravated by this accident. So there didn't seem any need for that instruction at that point. And the additional reasons were, according to this medical record, the only condition affecting Mr. Ayers' work as a flooring installer was his back pain. And finally, the fact that, according to this record, Mr. Ayers' treating physician at that time opined that it was very likely Mr. Ayers tore some component of his rotator cuff in the weightlifting incident, which contradicts, again, Dr. Wangler's opinion that the motor vehicle accident was what tore Mr. Ayers' rotator cuff. So this one-page document alone has all those reasons for the jury to find that this expert saying these conditions were caused by the motor vehicle accident just does not stack up with the evidence.
The judge had two other reasons for finding that the jury's findings were palpably contrary to the evidence. And the second reason was that the award of past medical expenses did not include any of the expenses that a respondent incurred to diagnose and treat the injuries to his shoulder and hand. Do you agree that that's palpably contrary to the evidence?
The fact that the jury did not award the medical expenses for those treatments is correct. That's what happened. But that's not contrary to the evidence in the case, because what the jury was clearly doing was compensating Mr. Ayers for the injuries that were reported and treated in the first several months after the accident. That was primarily headaches, sore neck, sore back. That's what he complained of after the accident. That's what he was treated for. That's what the jury compensated him for. It was about, it was 3 months after the accident when he first mentioned his shoulder at all, and that was only to say that he had injured it years ago while weightlifting, and it had bothered him ever since. Mentioned the hand later at some point, and the evidence showed that he had also had chronic carpal tunnel-like symptoms in his hand from years before this accident, 2 or 3 years before. And it wasn't until, I believe, about 10 or so months after the accident that a medical record finally says that Mr. Ayers is reporting a shoulder injury and or hand injury and attributing it to the accident. And it wasn't until almost 4 years after the accident that he had surgery on those conditions, which is where the bulk of those unawarded medical expenses came from. So this type of evidence has been found in case law as sufficient for a jury to find that an expert's opinion is not credible. What the case law, and there's a variety of cases that talk about this type of thing. In some cases, one side has an expert and the other side does not. In some cases, one side has two or three experts and the other side has none. There are even a couple cases where there's at least one expert on both sides, but they agree, and the jury is still allowed to find something else because there's other evidence in the case that points to a different conclusion or undermines the credibility of those experts' opinions. And just a couple of examples are the mnemonic versus Gopher Heating and Sheet Metal case, where the jury was not required to accept the opinion of the plaintiff's expert that his anxiety attacks were caused by the motor vehicle accident, even though there was no opposing expert, because medical records showed that he had had a history of anxiety attacks before that accident. And Rood versus Flood, another example where the plaintiff had three experts who said the injuries from his motor vehicle accident were permanent. The defense called no experts, but the jury was still allowed to find that there was no permanent injury.
Now, in those cases, did the district court grant a new trial, or did the district court deny a new trial?
Well, in some the cases are split in those types of arrangements. These particular cases, I'd have to check to see which was the case.
Yeah, and it's, I can't keep them all straight right this second either, but my read of those cases is that generally appellate courts are very deferential to whatever it is that the district court has done, because the district court is better situated, having sat through the trial, heard the evidence, and what have you, to make that decision.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the courts have reversed district courts or found the district courts abused their discretion both in not granting motions for new trial and in granting motions for new trial. So although it's true the district court is obviously accorded a lot of discretion, that discretion can be abused, and it was abused in this case because there was a wealth of evidence that the jury could hang its collective hat on in deciding not to follow the opinion of the one medical expert they heard in the case. And some examples from that variety of cases of things that that juries can rely on include medical records, obviously, cross-examinations of expert witnesses, the fact that a plaintiff complained little at the scene of the accident, the fact the plaintiff had minor complaints at the emergency room, the fact he was doing well at a later appointment, the fact he had history of other accidents, which the jury could find caused the injury, the fact that he did not report the alleged permanent conditions in a job application less than a year after the accident, and the fact that he was allowed to return to work about 2 weeks after the accident.
I will note that your time is up. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Respondent?
May it please the court and opposing counsel, Chris Goodman from Thompson Co. Cousins and Irons in St. Paul for the respondent, Justin Ayers. 8 years ago this week, a city plow goes across four lanes of traffic and rams into the side of my client's van. He was a driver, he is left-handed. As a result of the accident, he lost his van, his business. He was a self-employed flooring installer, which is relevant to Dr. Wengler's opinions in this case. I'll get to that. He also lost his home and had to relocate his family to South Dakota. Here we are 8 years later. Mr. Ayers hasn't recovered a dime for the case. A jury over 2 years ago found the accident was entirely the city's fault. So what issues on the second appeal in this case have the appellants brought to this court's attention? The first one, snow and ice immunity, I'm going to follow the order of the issues raised in the appellant's brief. I believe I have some case law that can answer a question. I believe Judge Bradfield raised. The issue is, the question was raised, if you're going to say that the contours of the trial were not fair or appropriate, can you raise that issue on appeal if you don't give the trial judge an opportunity to correct it? When I say contours of the trial, I mean the gatekeeping function of what evidence comes in, jury instructions, and also special verdict forms. I cited a case, I believe it was the Imlay decision from, I think, 1986, saying that under the Souder rule, special verdict forms fall under the contours of the trial. A trial judge has discretion on that issue. If you don't think you got a fair trial on that basis, you waive that appellate issue if you don't move for a new trial. Alpha Real Estate is the case in the reply brief that the appellants raised to say, no, the Souder rule has been modified by the Supreme Court, and now if it's a substantive question of law, I believe the court called it a demarcation line, then it's okay to bring it up on appeal for the first time. But what about the latter category, the Souder rule? This court in Moen versus Sunstone Hotel Properties, 818 Northwest 2nd 573, Penn sites 582, apparently I need bifocals, citing to Dang versus St. Paul Ramsey Medical Center, which is 490 Northwest 2nd, 653. The trial court has broad discretion both in writing jury instructions and in framing special verdict questions. Relying on Dang, which I just quoted, this court in Moen, if I'm saying that correctly, M-O-E-N, like the faucet, says that even after the Alpha Real Estate decision, if a party says the judge didn't get it right in the special verdict form, didn't properly ask the right questions to conform to the existing law, that is precisely the kind of issue that an appellant has to give the trial court a chance to correct or it's waived on appeal. So on the first issue that the appellants raise, my argument is waiver. I believe I've accounted for the Alpha Real Estate decision the council raised in the reply brief, and that issue should be knocked to the wayside. Out of an abundance of caution, I'll also talk about the merits of it. Hoffe Surman says, and the law in this state after that decision is, that if an accident involving a municipal vehicle is based on negligence and driving error, snow and ice immunity does not apply. That is based on Minnesota Statute 46603, which says that claims based upon, quote, based upon road and weather conditions, that's what's the trigger for the immunity. So tracking that statutory language, the decision of this court in Surman is, if you're saying the case, the accident, is caused by or based upon negligence and driving error, immunity doesn't apply. The question I believe Judge Roddenberg asked was, well, it doesn't necessarily seem that the finding of the judge, of this court in the earlier case, Ayers' appeal, was that there's a fact question, but rather the issue hasn't been matured or ripened. To that question, I believe, yes, I would agree, and what I believe Judge McManus was saying is, I have to hear the evidence. I have to weigh the evidence, and I'll consider it. Why is that, to address appellant's argument, why is that no longer relevant in this appeal? Well, at the time, Judge McManus said that, and at the time, this court commented on that finding, Hoffe Surman hadn't been decided. So by the time we got to trial, we brought a motion in limine to apply Hoffe Surman to this negligence and driving error case, and consistent with, and in fact bound by that precedent, it's a published decision, Judge McManus said, well, this is a negligence and driving error case, and therefore, consistent with Hoff, I'm going to exclude from the verdict form snow and ice immunity as an issue for the jury to consider. So on the merits of the issue, it's entirely appropriate and in fact compelled by precedent for Judge McManus to do what he did. But to my first point, the court doesn't even reach that. The issue has been waived. The second issue counsel raises on appeal is with respect to a new trial. Under Rule 59, when a judge is ordering a new trial when the damages are insufficient or not justified, the verdict is not justified by the evidence, the court has the broadest possible discretion. And that discretion is not disturbed unless it's clearly abused. The Journal, attorney named Roger Badeker in April of 92, said an abuse of discretion must be eye-popping, neck-snapping, jaw-dropping, egregious error. That's a pretty high bar. And with all due respect to counsel, the factual recitation they present to this court doesn't come close to reaching that high burden. Let's look first at the applicable law. Rupert versus Milwaukee Mutual Insurance Company. That is the case that addresses the deep issue in this case. If a party goes to trial with an expert, plaintiff in this case, because we have the burden of proof, but the defense doesn't have an expert, when and under what circumstances, if at all, can a jury, as Judge McManus found in this case, become their own doctors and disregard the opinions of a board-certified medical examiner in the absence of contrary medical testimony from an expert or a treating physician? And in this case, there was none of that. The law from Rupert is that, first of all, you have to look at whether...
Can you move for a directed verdict on that question?
You're ahead of me, Your Honor, but yes, on that point, we brought a motion in limine because there was no expert witness for the defense to prevent them from offering contrary medical conclusions. And that motion was granted, thereby limiting the defense to arguing about witness credibility, the Rupert rule. Consistent with that, I did in the trial ask the judge to consider a directed verdict on the issue of medical causation and permanency, the issues that are the subject of this appeal. And Judge McManus deferred ruling on that. And we know that the issue went to the jury because of the special verdict form. So was it there? Yes. Was there a ruling? No, it was deferred. The judge let the jury consider the issue. Okay. So the issue for the court is not whether the court erred in taking the issue away from the jury. That didn't happen. Again, getting back to Rupert, the issue is, to put them in order, did they establish that Dr. Wengler was not credible? To that, footnote 9 in our brief, I believe it's page 28, half a dozen citations to the record where Judge McManus, a seasoned trial attorney and a judge of 20 years on the bench, says the witness is credible. And we know that the role of an appellate court is not to delve into factual disputes or credibility determinations. I believe Judge Roddenberg pointed that out a moment ago. Because the trial court judge is there to actually hear the testimony live, as opposed to reading the transcript, having to rely on the written record. And that's what the appellants in this case are asking the court to do. So on the issue of impeachment, credibility, Judge McManus made a specific finding repeatedly that the witness was credible. Secondarily, then, under Rupert, we look at improbability or inconsistency of the expert opinions. I'll lump those two together. What we have featured in appellant's argument is this April 2011 medical record. Now, first of all, and again, as Judge McManus pointed out, that was a record that was available to Dr. Wengler. He considered it. He specifically asked Mr. Ayers about it in connection with the IME. And I believe it's page 14 of our brief, we quote Dr. Wengler's trial testimony saying that the treating doctor, Jessen, if I'm saying it correctly, might have been onto something. There might have been some damage done to Mr. Ayers' shoulder in connection with the weightlifting accident. But considering he never sought treatment, the weightlifting accident was 5 years before the van and the plow hits the van. He concedes that there might be something to that concern that Dr. Jessen expresses. But considering Mr. Ayers never sought medical attention in the 5 years after and continued to work in a strenuous job as a flooring installer, hauling 200-pound rolls of carpeting over his shoulder, far more strenuous than anything I do at my desk job, right? It's just it's simply incredible for Dr. Wengler to then conclude that Mr. Ayers was walking around with a bum shoulder for 5 years. The other issue, not addressed by the appellants, is our burden was not to show that the motor vehicle accident was the sole cause of the accident. The jury was instructed accurately under the law, it's direct cause. Direct cause was this accident a probable factor in bringing about the injury? So one, number one, it is not inconsistent for Dr. Wengler, as he said, and I believe this involves some intellectual honesty, to say, sure, there could have been some damage done by weightlifting 5 years prior. But the question that Dr. Wengler was asked to opine on, and the jury, for whatever reason, chose not to accept, is that the motor vehicle accident, which is what led to all the treatment and diagnosis of this injury, is what, in fact, led to the shoulder injury. Another point, and I'm drawing a blank, I believe it was Judge Riley brought this up, I think it's very telling that counsel asked for the aggravation instruction going into trial, but after all the votes have been cast and the evidence is in, we have a follow-up charge conference, if you will, on the record. Counsel withdraws the instruction, 91.40. I don't believe we need that one, Your Honor. We then get a specific finding from Judge McManus saying, even if you'd asked for it, I wouldn't have allowed it, because there wasn't any medical testimony or evidence to confirm that the plaintiff in this case had a pre-existing medical condition. So with all due respect, it's a bit disingenuous to come here 2 years later and say Judge McManus got it wrong, when without even making an offer of proof, counsel withdraws the request for a jury instruction. If I look at my notes quickly, I believe counsel's argument on that was I can't even read my notes. There was an argument from counsel as to why it made sense to withdraw the aggravation instruction. I believe the argument from counsel was, well, we weren't arguing that the motor vehicle accident aggravated a pre-existing condition. Well, that's nonsensical. There was no treatment, not even a complaint to a doctor. Hey, doctor, my shoulder hurts, at any point before the accident. So it makes absolutely no sense to come before the court today and say, well, there was a good reason to withdraw the aggravation instruction. We weren't saying or arguing that this accident aggravated a pre-existing condition. So
time always gets short in these arguments, yeah. And I want to jump you to the subrogation question, because I'm just not sure how we handle that in light of the legislature's enactment of 65B51 subdivision 1. I recognize that the case on which the district court relied has not been expressly overruled, but the statute has changed in the meantime. If we were to affirm the district court on that issue, what would you propose that we use as our syllabus point to publish to say that there's a subrogation right notwithstanding subdivision 1?
I've got 2 minutes and 45 seconds, and I'll do my best to spit this out. The rationale in Langenbrenner, if I'm saying it correctly, from 1983 was, nothing in 65B.53 says the right of indemnity exists to the exclusion of the right of subrogation. That was a decision of the trial court that was overturned. 65B.53 still says that. There's still nothing in there. We know that if the legislature, in its inestimable wisdom, disagreed with that, they could have simply put the word only in front of indemnity, for instance, in subdivision one, avoided the whole problem. We also know, for whatever it's worth.
Then of sure. Subdivision one of B51, that is the deduction of the basic economic loss benefits if, in fact, there's a subrogation right that takes care of the basic economic loss benefits.
I'm not sure I'm tracking the question, but I'll spit out an answer as best I can with the time sure. remaining. I believe Your Honor is speaking to what I called in my brief dicta by the Supreme Court saying, well, apparently the legislature no longer believes or concludes that the right of subrogation should exist coextensive with the right of indemnity for insureds injured by commercial vehicles. That's not binding precedent on this court. It certainly wasn't relevant or germane to the issue before the Supreme Court in Langenbrunner, which
no, is... No, because it was applying the law that, as it existed at the time of the accident.
Right. What I'm saying is, in Langenbrunner, the Supreme Court is saying, speculating as to what, the Your Honor's question, what the significance of an amendment to 65B51 meant. And what I'm saying is, first of all, the thought process in Langenbrunner is still sound, that we have indemnity and subrogation and nothing saying that one operates to the exclusion of the other. But to reinforce that, we know that if the No-Fault Act didn't exist, Mr. Ayer's insurer would have had a right of equitable indemnity from and also equitable and contractual subrogation.
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Right. So to get to my Latin phrase that I put in the brief that I'm not going to try and spit out, but also the way this works, in my opinion, with Langenbrunner, we're not saying that if you adopt the district court's position, we're finding a right of subrogation in the statute. The subrogation right exists. The question is, can we look at the language of the statute and say that the legislature intended to take away the right of subrogation? And that's the State v. Boker, if I'm saying it correctly, a Supreme Court case in 2017. That's a statute of a canon of statutory construction. You don't read a statute as saying, by providing for X, we take away Y, unless it's ambiguous. There's never been a finding the statute's ambiguous. It wasn't argued by the appellant. The district court didn't find so. Many cases are cited on the statute in appellant's brief, and none of them say the statute is ambiguous. So my position is, my time is up, the court would have to find the statute is ambiguous to read into 65B.53 the conclusion that, contrary to Langenbrunner, the legislature intended to take away the common law right to subrogation by creating a right of indemnity.
I have one additional question, not on that point.
Sure.
On this computation question, sort of the, I think it's the fourth issue that's identified, it's not clear to me whether the parties actually have a firm agreement as to what the computation would be. Do you think we need to remand to the district court to recompute?
With all due respect, my thoughts on that would be that that's going to be inherent in what the court has to do on remand, especially if there's any dispute over interest, which there was the first go-around.
Right. But you now agree that the date for starting interest was incorrect.
The date issue is gone, so that invites a new determination by the court, so the administrator knows what the judgment is.
You think
about.
We have to remand?
On that, yeah. Okay. And then also we've got the $2,500 medical expense follow-up work on my part revealed. We got a credit for it, so we removed it.
Okay.
So it's out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use it.
I do, Your Honor. Thank you. Again, I'm Patrick Arneson, for the record. Just briefly going back to the collateral source offset question, the case law is clear. There is, and the statutes as they currently exist in the No-Fault Act, are clear that there is no subrogation right remaining to a no-fault carrier under these circumstances. That was taken away when the No-Fault Act was amended in 1976 and 77, because when Langenberger was decided, or at least when the Langenberger accident occurred, the statute provided for the no-fault carrier to elect that right of subrogation, but that was written out of the statute, and case law has expressly recognized that there no longer is a common law right to subrogation in those circumstances. So all that exists is what's in the No-Fault Act, and the only subrogation rights are if the accident occurred out of state, which isn't the case here.
Or intentional tort.
Right, if it falls into one of those categories which doesn't apply. So the collateral offset should absolutely have been applied in this case. And then just briefly on the interest aspect, I'd agree that it does need to be remanded with some directions because it wasn't just the date of interest accrual overall that was in dispute. It was accrual of interest on specific items of damages because only some medical expenses were awarded and subrogation interest was asserted as to only some of those items of medical expenses. So it's a fairly common, or
if we were to determine that there is no subrogation right, then you have to do the numbers from the get-go anyway, right?
That's another reason why it would need to be changed, Your Honor. But it's a relatively complex calculation, as it turns out, and the district court just blanket awarded interest for everything without parsing that out. So that there would need to be some instruction there. But I do want to go back to some of the aspects of the new trial. One is the argument that the district court's position that basically the jury had to agree with Dr. Wengler's opinions because Dr. Wengler had access to the same medical records the jury did, and it didn't change his opinion. He came to a different conclusion about it. But there's certainly not case law that says just because an expert looks at medical records means the jury is not allowed to read the medical record and see what it says and does not say. Because here it wasn't, as the district court articulated, a case of the jury becoming their own doctors. They didn't need to become doctors. They didn't need an MD to see that a medical record, that any of the medical records in the several months after the accident, that none of them had Mr. Ayers reporting left shoulder and left hand injuries from the accident. That's just a simple matter of can you read this document and see what it says and doesn't say. And he didn't report those injuries. Therefore, it was reasonable for the jury to conclude that maybe Dr. Wengler was not correct about these permanent injuries being caused by this accident if Mr. Ayers never even complained about him after the accident until months afterwards.
Well, was there treatment between the date of the alleged weightlifting injury and the date of the accident?
Not that we have records for, Your Honor.
Okay, but the first mention, you say that was months after, I don't know how many months, but it was some time after the accident, correct? It's remote from the date of the accident. It's even more remote from the date of the alleged weightlifting injury.
It is, Your Honor, but Dr. Wengler's argument and the district court's position on that can support, in fact, appellants here, because what Dr. Wengler was saying is that his conclusion from Mr. Ayers not seeing anyone about the shoulder condition before the motor vehicle accident was it just wasn't that big of a deal. Well, that's...
He was working, doing some laboring stuff?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
The same explanation same argument could be made for why didn't Mr. Ayers report this condition right after the accident? The fact that he didn't report it doesn't mean he didn't have the condition. It's just that he didn't choose to report it to the doctors, perhaps because he had been working through it. It hadn't made a difference to him. His work restrictions after the accident had nothing to do with his left shoulder or left hand.
The deal where you're trying to tell us that the record here is that he hit his finger with the hammer some years earlier and yelled, ow, 10 months after the accident.
I guess I'm not sure I understand the analogy, Your Honor.
Well, it's so remote from the what you're claiming that the jury concluded was that it was due to this weightlifting incident that happened some years before the accident, correct? That's what the jury must have concluded in the first trial.
That's likely, Your Honor, but they didn't need to conclude that. They just had to find that Dr. Wengler's opinion was not credible because it didn't match this other evidence. But that's a very strong piece of evidence that they did have to consider.
Aren't we all just speculating what their deliberations really entail? Because we only have their answers to the special verdict form, not how they did their calculations or what they credited or didn't credit.
Well, we don't know from the jury exactly which pieces of evidence they gave weight, but it seems fairly clear from the record that they did give weight to the pieces of evidence that contradicted Dr. Wengler's opinion on causation because they clearly did not follow Dr. Wengler's opinion on causation of the left shoulder and left hand. I'm out of time, so thank you very much.
Thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument. Interesting issues. The matter is submitted, and we'll issue our decision within 90 days of today's date. Thank you.
Thank you.